Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people who have different perspectives from me. And then we just talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. And I include you in that comment because I enjoy hearing what you think about these topics as well. Welcome to the second half of the conversation with Dr. Mark Glanville, who is the Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. Last week, we heard about his childhood in Australia and how he ventured into the jazz world. We had that great mini lesson on listening to the sounds of the blues, and Dr. Glanville gave a tremendous overview of biblical history. I was particularly struck by his statement that the perpetrators of oppression and evil lose elements of their humanity and thus the ability to create impactful art. Wow. To start this week's conversation, I want to continue the biblical connection with music. If the blues get us to the foot of Mount Sinai, what sounds go with the wilderness wanderings and with moving into the land of inheritance?
Well, I think there has to be lament because that's our story. That's where we've come from, and it's still our story. And I think that's one of the things the blues teaches us and the African-American spiritual community and theologians teach us. There has to be lament. There has to be that blues moan and a gospel shout, you know. That somehow, I mean, I think that's what the blues does. That, I mean, Otis Moss III says that our entire theological genome is packaged in the hum of the song, passed down after generations by generations. And I find that remarkable, you know, that in these sounds, say the blues, they're the sounds that I hear. You can hear the celebration. You can hear the shout, we've survived, and we've survived together, and we've survived because of Jesus. And yet you can hear the reality of life this side of Jesus' return. But even with the hope of Jesus' return, that certain hope, I do think the blues are still going to be played when Jesus comes and renews everything. What does it mean then, I think, to be a community of Christ followers that faces the world as Christ faces the world? What does it mean to grieve what Christ grieves in the world and to celebrate what Christ celebrates in the world? I think that's what the blues can teach us. And I think, if you don't mind me saying, African-American theology too can teach us. Sometimes I think we can be dulled in our emotional responses to the world's realities, both in our neighborhood, our very local neighborhood where we worship, but also nationally and globally. What does it mean to grieve what Christ grieves and to celebrate what Christ celebrates? And I think that the blues leads us, because of its provenance, where it's come from, and because of the way it speaks deeply to the human spirit, I think it can teach us to grieve what Christ grieves. It's a whole theological package in these notes. Sometimes I think there's a lot more said just in that than in an entire theological textbook about what's real.
You have stated before that jazz or the blues and biblical law, both of these two things together, they sing the song of lament and hope. And that's it sounds a little bit like what you've been talking about. And both of those sounds somehow coming through at the same time, which is really interesting because we're not always very emotive in church, depending on what church traditions people are in. And so we kind of disassociate the theology that we have from the emotions that we feel. But if we really embrace this idea of biblical law, the biblical narrative, sounding the sounds of lament while also sounding the sounds of victory and hope, that's a really interesting concept. And I feel, you know, as someone who doesn't have the same trained ears that you have, I feel like that's an area I can grow in learning to hear the sounds at the same time.
I think you're right. A friend of mine, Lauren Beliski, who birthed Kinbrace, which is a welcome housing advocacy support for refugees here in Vancouver. Lauren said, he held his hands sort of just a couple of inches apart, and he said, you know, in the reality of the world, celebration and lament are always this far apart. And at Kinbrace, which is just a few blocks away from our house, on Tuesday evenings they eat together as a community, and our family often joins them. And it's a celebration together of we've survived, but also the lament of family who are back at home and can't join, or the lament of a deportation order from the Refugee Board of Canada. And I think that in the cross and the resurrection, we see lament and celebration. In the cross, when Jesus was buried, we can think of all the muck and the filth in the world, of the world buried there with Jesus. And yet Jesus dies, even as he puts to death, he dies in solidarity with a broken world. And so as long as we are people of the cross, we're people who are in solidarity with the brokenness of the world. Jesus in the cross, as James Cone said so well, wrung a victory out of oppression, wrung a victory out of evil in the great mystery of that Roman oppression, which is the cross, this divine mystery. And in the resurrection that Jesus rose from the dead as the first fruits of this world renewed, yet as people of the cross, we're in solidarity with the brokenness, but in solidarity with hope. I think that's what the blues points us to. You know, Cindy, one of the interesting things that happened in the 50s and 60s is that the jazz was developed, and it was developed often by quite young African-Americans in American urban environments, where the blues gained a deep musical sophistication. And so in that music, we don't just hear lament and celebration. We sometimes hear a lot of anger. And this is anger that perhaps even brings us to our current context of Black Lives Matter. And we hear that in jazz music too. And sometimes even the enhanced dissonance and the very close kind of chromatic clusters of notes that form jazz chords and jazz harmony and jazz improvisations line doesn't just sing celebration and lament, but even a very deep visceral anger of a people. Yeah.
What does that sound like when that happens, when anger is added or when the blues become more sophisticated?
Yeah, sure. I mean, jazz tonality at its heart, I mean, if you were to kind of caricature classical music as kind of a triad, say in C, it would be C, E, G, if you like. At the heart of jazz tonality, you can, you know, for the musicians on this call, you'll know that stacked third. C to E is a third, E to G is a third. And at the heart of jazz music, we stack a few more thirds on top. We'd add the seventh, which is the B in C. Another third would take you to the 11th, which is the D. And then another third will take you up to the next F, which is a 13th, and even to the A. And the point of what these stack thirds do is it gives a dense sound and beautiful colors to the sound, and it adds a certain tension and chromaticism. that gives the sound, the music, something of its characteristic spirit. So let me just play, say, I just play a simple jazz standard, say, to try and illustrate Great. That. Of course, there can be such a deep beauty, you know, in jazz standards as well. What could be a fun one to play? Let me play There's No Greater Love. It's an old jazz standard. Yeah.
Great.
So I'll try and illustrate some of these sounds. There you go. That's No Greater Love, an old jazz standard.
I have to admit, I am absolutely loving this personalized concert for us. Mark's passion for the sounds and the story shine through. During our interview, after he played, we spent time talking about the complications of two white people talking about the pain and resilience that is embedded or even embodied in jazz.
To be honest, Cindy, and this is something that I'll take, you know, to my dying days, it's unsolvable, is the complexity of a white musician like me playing jazz music, because it's not my music in a way. It's just a bottomless and very important thing to think about. I mean, for myself, no one invited me to learn jazz and the blues. When I started down in Australia, when I was kind of a teenager, I didn't even know of the history. I just knew of the sounds and I was attracted to it. No one invited me to play it, and no one's laid hands on me to bless me and to bless me to play their music. So what does that mean? I mean, it means for me, I have to learn the story and try and live within the story faithfully. Mm. It goes well beyond jazz musicians, though, Cindy. It's so significant that there's barely any modern music form in the West that's not deeply, deeply grounded in the blues. I mean, from folk music to country music that, you know, even white supremacist groups such as the Proud Boys, I'm sure, listen to, you know, let alone, of course, hip-hop and soul and R&B, certainly pop music, you know. But it all owes its soul and its depths of human feeling to the blues, you know. You think of some, I mean, I sometimes think of someone like Taylor Swift or something, you know. It's pretty thin music, you know, to anyone who really loves music. But it still speaks to the human spirit in some way, at least to the teenage human spirit, because of its roots of the blues. That's why it works. And so somehow all these musical art forms that really shapes and, you know, all of contemporary Western culture, including white supremacist culture, is rooted in the blues. And needless to say, there's a deep ethical ambivalence around that. What does it mean, you know, to love country music and yet to be a white supremacist when country music owes its sounds to this beautiful, profoundly rooted art form in a story, in a people? There's a thousand paradoxes.
Yeah.
An ongoing evil, frankly.
You just released a book that you wrote with your brother, which is very fun that you had a project like that. He's not, he doesn't do biblical studies as a profession, right? He's in a whole different other field. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Luke Lamville's, he's an international relations scholar and political theology. He's at Australian National University in Canberra, capital city there in Canberra. And so Luke studies, he sort of studies the history of national sovereignty, the history of atrocities. He studied genocide, and he studies also just the history of borders, and which relates to national sovereignty, right? You know, one of the things he's been looking at the last few years is, historically, in the last 500 years, what does it mean to be a nation? What's it mean to be a nation with borders? What does it mean to be someone who's seeking borders? And so that's just so relevant, of course, for today's contemporary situation, not just of U.S.-Mexican immigration for Americans, but just an unprecedented time in human history right now with literally 80 million people displaced globally. So Luke's work is really wonderful. Yeah, and that's right, Cindy. We discovered that we were both working on forced displacement as scholars and just, you know, with our heads and hearts thinking through and feeling through what is our responsibility to people on the move who are seeking a home, you know. And Luke was doing this back in Australia and I was doing this in Canada as a biblical studies guy myself. And I was getting stuck because, you know, I had this biblical ethic, but then people would talk to me and they'd say, yeah, well, Mark, you know, they'd kind of throw political questions at me, you know, what about employment, you know, or what about if our national identity gets threatened, or what about if they're terrorists, you know? And I mean, I think we all have some answers to that, but I didn't have, you know, the deepest answers by any means. But then Luke in Canberra, where he was doing some terrific work on these kind of political realities as a political thinker, but then Christians would push him on biblical ethics, you know, and so he'd get a bit stuck, you know. They might say, oh, well, you know, what about the Canaanites, you know, there's nothing welcoming about that, you know. And so then we were kind of on this call one day and we just kind of say, oh, I got this problem, you know, and Luke would say, well, I got this problem. And we said, what if we wrote a book? And what if we wrote a book that just was this, put a stake in the ground and showed not only God's heart for welcoming and for generosity that reflects God's own character and is this relentless ethic in the Old and New Testaments, unarguable, but brought this together with the political, theological and international relations realities that Luke can articulate so well. And what if we just close down all these, if you don't mind me saying, selfish arguments that argue really more out of just national interest, you know, what about if we're encouraging terrorists? And what about the boat people, we say in Australia? And just show, no, this biblical ethic is not only a biblical reality for those who worship our God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, but it's actually profoundly doable. And contrary to threatening our national security, it actually, you know, empirically, it enhances our economic well-being. It enhances our experience of life. We know that from empirical study, but in the end, you know, we don't want to be a welcoming nations just because it enhances our well-being. We want to be a welcoming nation because it's right.
Is this your same brother who was the jazz drummer?
Yeah, right, yeah. But this is very significant, Cindy, because brothers need a shared project to stay in touch.
Right.
not our sister.
I just... I just find it really interesting that you have this musical element growing up that right. has greatly informed, anyway, the way that you are thinking about biblical law and justice right. and lament and hope.
Right.
And your brother shares the same background. And then in modern day, you're able to bring your newer skills to the table and still engage the same yeah. conversation with different perspectives. But in a way, your scholarship is being birthed out of jazz and the blues, which is really cool.
Cheers. Yeah, and jazz very explicitly comes up in our book a few times, Cindy. You'll appreciate this as a biblical scholar. I think it's a very helpful metaphor for understanding how we bring the biblical tradition to bear on ethical issues today, you know? One of the things we say it a couple of times in our book, Refuge Reimagined, we show how, you know, we learn, you see, as jazz musicians back in our 20s, back in our teenage years, we immersed in the sounds of jazz. We spent thousands of hours tapping the rhythms, you know, and learning the harmonies, just listening and practicing, learning the tradition, which is a little bit similar to learning the biblical tradition. You know, as biblical scholars, but just as Christians, we learn the biblical tradition. But how do you put that into practice today? You know, on a complex issue such as, you know, refugee welcome or immigration, 80 million people seeking a home, or the U.S.-Mexican border, you know, it's a different context to the Gospels, different context to Exodus or Deuteronomy, the books we've spoken about today. And Luke and I argue that what we're called to do as Christians is to learn the tradition, to soak ourselves in the biblical story, in biblical ethics, in the heart of God. And then as jazz musicians, what we do now, we've learned the tradition. Every time we come to play, even as I did just now, is a fresh performance, which requires fresh imagination and fresh lyricism and fresh songs, fresh entrepreneurial thoughts that and sparks. And each time Luke and I come and play with one another, which isn't as often as we'd like because we live on opposite sides of the rotten Pacific Ocean, which turns out to be a very big ocean, Cindy, but maybe Luke more often in Canberra, and me more often in Vancouver with Vancouver musicians, we're listening to one another and we're learning from one another in a very dynamic way. But I think as Christians, when it comes to biblical ethics and mission, that out of this tradition, in our fresh cultural context, in our fresh neighborhood moment, we play fresh improvisations on the tradition. We never let go of the biblical tradition, but out of this tradition, by the Spirit, our imagination is open wide. How can we display the tenderness of God in Christ in this moment of massive forced displacement? How can we show the tenderness and generosity of Christ in relation to the U.S.-Mexican border? And I think that one of the things that is very significant for Luke and I that we bring out in our book is that this isn't just a matter of will of charity. Will we be the generous people, and how generous will we be? First of all, we have God's heart. But just as profoundly, we're complicit in the forced displacement we're talking about. You know, the U.S. it has been engaged in historical injustices for decades now in South America, in Mexico and in South America, and with trade rules and the influence of multinationals and the support of American government and ongoing bullying on the part of the U.S. government, it creates the very economic conditions that create the poverty that allow gangs to flourish, the unjust trade policies that create the economic just situation that means that there is this violence, that people are fleeing. Let alone Canada and Australia, we could say quite the same thing. The truth is that Canada and Australia, we benefit a lot more. I think the stat is literally 14 times more from developing countries from unjust trade rules than we give in aid. And that's a reality in the West. We benefit 14 times more from unjust trade rules than we give in aid. So we're complicit in the forced displacement. And we talk about this in our book, and we make it very specific, say when it comes to the Syrian civil war right now, about the way Western nations who are trying to make these kind of very righteous decisions, you know, do we protect our own or do we let the Syrians in? We show how no, Western nations have been complicit in creating the dysfunction that brought about the civil war. And so these things are very important. So Luke and I have brought together biblical studies and political theology to try and make a case that closes down those silly arguments. And we hope that it's a book that's based deeply in the scholarship, but it's also accessible to people.
Fantastic. I'm glad the two of you wrote it.
Thanks, Cindy.
I think it's a book we probably all need to sit with, maybe chew on a bit slowly, and maybe put on some blues while we read it, you know, read it with the sounds of lament and hope while reading and thinking through some of those issues. I think that would be brilliant. Yeah. Maybe I'll start a reading club and we can do that together.
Please. Yeah, we'd love to. we'd love to drop in on your final meeting and say hi.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was great fun. I've never done a podcast episode yet where I had such wonderful live music at the same time, and I am hooked, so awesome. I may have to keep doing this with you just so I can get these private concerts.
Right? So wonderful. That sounds good. Yeah, that sounds really good. Thanks so much, Cindy. It was such a joy to combine biblical theology with music in our conversation. I really enjoyed it.
What a fantastic conversation. I hope Dr. Glanville got your mind thinking. Feel free to contact me and let me know what you think about jazz and biblical law. And yes, I do know that Taylor Swift just won a Grammy for Album of the Year. Be sure to like or follow this podcast, because next week I get to talk with Ruth Naomi Floyd about her project in which she takes the words of Frederick Douglass and pairs them with jazz. Her voice is absolutely magical, and I'm hoping she'll treat us to a mini concert as well. The ability to bring conversations like this to you is made possible through my team on Patreon. People like Kathy and Scott Parker, otherwise known as Mom and Dad Parker, they make this podcast sustainable and commercial-free for all of you. If you want to be a part of the team, you will find a link in the episode notes of the show. As always, it is wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you and with these scholars here at this virtual table. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created the opening music, and Mark Glanville played all the piano segments, including this version of Amazing Grace. I look forward to our conversation next week. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.